Welcome, everyone, to this live episode of Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev, and today I'm joined by Danny Roderick, who is the Ford Foundation Professor of International Political Economy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Last week, Danny wrote an article titled How I Became a Manufacturing Skeptic, which has generated a lot of online discussion. So in this episode, we're going to discuss some of his evolving views, the evidence that changed his mind, and what this means for future growth strategies. And if you are listening live, then please do ask questions using the Q&A function on Zoom. You can also vote for other people's questions if you'd like to see those answered. And we will leave time at the end to get around to as many of those as possible. Danny, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thank you, Oliver. Thanks for having me.
So, Danny, I wanted to start with what your view on growth used to be, which you've outlined many times before, including in an article called The Manufacturing Imperative. Could you quickly summarize for us what these ideas used to be about the growth process that countries should be aiming for?
Yes, I think my basic ideas about growth have not changed all that much over the years. I think the relative importance of different components in different vehicles for promoting economic growth, I think the weight I put on different parts have changed. I think it's useful to step back and just spend a couple of minutes as to sort of how I view growth and its drivers in low and middle income countries. I find it useful to distinguish between two channels of economic growth. One I call fundamentals, the other I call structural change. Fundamentals really is what we think about when we think about long-term economic growth in the standard neoclassical model of convergence, and it's all about getting basic broad capabilities developed. And that's really about, human capital. It's about, basic governance. It's about broad infrastructure. In order to get rich, and, those are the things that you need to build. But this delivers steady but not startlingly high growth. So I think the standard estimate is that you get maybe around 2%. Sort of, 2-3% growth off of this if you're doing all your homework right. This is not largely how East Asian countries and the most rapid growing countries have gotten growth. How they've gotten growth is essentially through the shortcut of structural change. How structural change works is by basically moving your resources, basically labor, from low productivity to high productivity activities, because every developing country is highly dualistic. It's essentially a set of islands of high productivity in a kind of a sea of very low productivity, subsistence agriculture, informal activities. The more rapidly and the more in a sustained fashion you can push your resources, your labor into these higher productivity activities, the more rapid you can grow. And historically, it's been industrialization that has provided the vehicle for that structural change. Essentially, manufacturing traditionally had the has the properties that it is high productivity. Productivity tends to converge. There's unconditional convergence as in manufacturing, as I've shown. And it's a kind of an escalator that keeps rising, but it's also very wide, which is you can put a lot of people on that escalator because the skill requirements aren't that demanding. So manufacturing has been this very powerful lever for growth historically because it doesn't make huge demand on your fundamental capabilities. And that's where you get the most rapid growth in low and middle income countries. That's the story of East Asian export-oriented industrialization, but also earlier cases. If you go back to, Southern Europe, Spain and Portugal and Italy, right after the Second World War, you got, Germany or the United States during their period. It's all about sort of rapid industrialization that drives this. So that's the standard framework. So I think that is still the right way to think about economic growth. I think, though, that what has changed over time is the ability of manufacturing to serve that sort of very as a very wide escalator. Remember, one of the key things that made manufacturing special in the story is that it could accommodate a lot of the economy's labor because it did not make huge demands on skills and capabilities. That is no longer true. And I think that's the fundamental change that we're experiencing, while sort of even the most successful, latest generation industrializers, whether it's Bangladesh or Vietnam or Cambodia, are really lagging behind in terms of, how many people they can put into manufacturing. And the rest of the world are nowhere even near there. So that's really has forced me. We can talk br more broadly, if you will, about, sort of where I get that, sort of where high my views have changed over time, if you will. But it's that accumulated evidence, and then my, having to think about sort of if not manufacturing, then what else? And there, that's where I end up right now.
Yeah, and could you expand a bit on that process of realization about manufacturing not holding the promise that it once did? When exactly did you start to feel that? What types of specific evidence did you see where which made you kind of reevaluate that?
It's really about it's been about a decade, really, because if you go back, in fact, I was looking back, just before our conversation, the piece you mentioned, the manufacturing imperative, which was a short op-ed for Project Syndicate, was written 15 years ago. And that was just about when I first put out the working paper on the paper called Unconditional Convergence in Manufacturing, which showed that manufacturing, formal manufacturing, to be clear, had this property of unconditional convergence, which means that it really doesn't matter whether you have, you're an open economy, you have good macro pro stability, where you have, good institutions or, lots of skills. Manufacturing, formal manufacturing, tends to converge to the productivity frontier, which made it really special in terms of. So that was back the working paper that was sort of like 2011, which is also when I wrote that that piece in Project Syndicate. That paper got published in 2013. By 2015, I published another piece, that one called Premature Deindustrialization in Manufacturing. And that was really sort of where I was looking across countries. I was noticing there was very clear evidence that was not new, was sort of had been creeping over the decades, that basically every generation of developing countries were reaching peak levels of employment industrialization at much lower levels of industrialization. And they were reaching that at much lower levels of per capita GDP too. So if you think about this manufacturing curve over the sort of span of a country's development, you tend to sort of manufacturing employment as a share of employment tends to rise. And then at some point it begins to decline as you move into the tertiary sectors, the sector. So that manufacturing curve every decade, essentially since the 1970s, has been shifting down and has been shifting closer to the origin, which is those two changes, that you're reaching peak levels of industrialization at much lower levels of income, at much lower levels of manufacturing employment. And so that was the cross-country sort of evidence that started really made me think that there's that this process was got. Then it became clear when I was looked closer at what was happening at global value chains, because which essentially by the 2000s had become the main mechanism through which countries were joining sort of the global markets in terms of being able to export manufacturing. And it was clear that increasingly the global value, joining global value chains, required capabilities that were really, the most sophisticated that these countries had. And sort of basically, if you think about South Korea and Taiwan in the 60s, 70s, they're exporting manufacturing based on the resource that they have the most of, which was low skill labor. But if you're trying to join a global value chain today, it's making demands of skills, of capabilities, of infrastructure, of logistics, of technological capability, of governance. That is precisely what these countries lack. Trade in manufacturing, which was once a kind of a shortcut, that was able to evade your primary constraint on why you weren't getting richer, now sort of became, that shortcut was no longer there, because you look at all, sort of reports on, sort of what do countries need to do to join global value chains and so forth. It's really about, going back to fundamentals. It's about, you need to improve your skills, you need to improve your infrastructure, you need to improve your governance. Yes, of course, that's how you get rich in the long run. But the whole point about industrialization was how it was essentially traditionally a kind of a shortcut around these constraints, and that shortcut no longer exists. I think much more concretely, I think I changed, sort of this all came to a head in my mind much more clearly when I did some work with colleagues on understanding Ethiopia's process of industrialization. And Ethiopia is interesting because it was one of the countries that was slated to essentially replicate the Stasian model of industrialization in East Africa. And they tried very hard. They invited Chinese and other investors. They created industrial parks. The government explicitly promoted a kind of an East Asian style industrial policy approach. They had some success, but when we look closer, what was striking was what a narrow sliver of employment in manufacturing that they had created in these parks. Even though industrial manufacturing, manufacturing employment was growing, the bulk of it actually was very small, informal enterprises, which don't have this feature of sort of, this productive trajectory that I described before. And so that was the same also in a lot of other countries in Africa and Middle East. So it became quite clear that we're entering a very different era. I should say one other thing. So paradoxically, just as the evidence on manufacturing not being capable of acting as a growth escalator was becoming clear, in the 2 decades or so before the pandemic, developing countries on the whole grew pretty rapidly. So this was actually a good period for developing countries, not a bad period. And then the paradox was, how is it that actually is possible for developing countries to grow rapidly when in fact, it wasn't industrialization? So who were, sort of India is the paradigmatic case, of course, after, the late 1990s. It wasn't driven by manufacturing at all. But it wasn't just India. You look at, even Ethiopia, you look at our countries in East and West Africa, you look at a lot of the growth pickups in Latin America after the late 1990s, early 2000s. It's not driven by manufacturing. So there were also hints, and where is it driven for? It's driven by services. It's driven by workers moving into more productive services. Now, there's a question as to whether, the productivity dynamics of those services and so forth. But it was clear that we also had the makings potentially of an alternative model of growth that was much more service-based, and that, of course, is takes. Maybe we will discuss this later on about sort of where that alternative model might, what it might look like.
Yeah, and it's interesting you raise Ethiopia. So we just recorded an episode that will be coming out soon with Mamo Miretu, who was the governor of Ethiopia's central bank, and spoke not just about their kind of industrial push, but also the fundamentals that they've been working on getting right to put Ethiopia in a position to continue growing. I wanted to get into more specifically the new approach or the non-manufacturing approach that you would be recommending countries try to follow now. Could you give some more specifics on that in terms of how you would summarize what that approach looks like?
So I think the clearest example is obviously is India. There's a very nice paper by economists at Yale, Fan Peters and Zilibotti, on sort of the Indian model of service-led growth. Now, I think we everybody knows that that services have done very well in India, but of course. When they think about services, they think about IT or BPO, those kind of services, which are relatively skill intensive, and in fact, they absorb a tiny share of India's labor force. And India's economic growth, by and large, has not been driven by these tradable, skill intensive services. And that's what sort of this nice paper shows, that it's been much more the growth of sort of non-tradable consumer services, everything from hospitality to retail to care to local transport, to local food services. So everything that we associate with the local economy, in which we traditionally think of as being very informal, very low productivity, and that that there has been some expansion of productive activity there, and that's created better jobs, more incomes, in turn feed back to sort of more demand for these services. And that kind of it is possible to think of a kind of a model of how a virtuous cycle of middle class services, mostly based on these consumer urban consumer services, can create kind of a cycle of growth, where higher incomes generate more employment in turn generates higher income, and then expands the size of the market. Gives the push for improvements in quality, which in turn justifies sort of higher incomes and so forth. So there are signs of that happening in a lot of countries. The same economists have a paper also in that covers the high growth episodes before the pandemic in Africa, where they show the importance of services. We look at what's been happening in Latin America, everything from Brazil to Colombia to Peru. Some of that is driven by, of course, natural resource exports, but a lot of it has really been sort of an expansion of domestic services as well. So manufacturing has been, basically missing in action in all these sort of recent growth cases. What we don't know, and I think this is where my worth focuses on, is there's a big difference between the kinds of services I'm talking about and manufacturing. Sort of one is that with manufacturing, we had a kind of a handle on productivity growth. We know you copy state of the art, and then secondly, it is tradable. So you can actually export abroad, so you're not limited by the size of the domestic market. With services, neither of those is true. And therefore, one issue you have to be concerned is about is that, unlike in manufacturing, you can't have a strategy where you're sequentially, emphasizing one service after another, because they all have to be sold domestically. So it can't be like you're going from, street vendors and then to restaurants and then to drivers to then teachers and the community health workers. You have to do it all at once, and that necessarily reduces, I think, the growth ceiling. You cannot grow nearly as rapidly in a sustainably in a services driven model than in a manufacturing model, because of the role of non-traded versus traded. The second is the productivity bit. Now, historically, these services have not been productively dynamic, because we've thought about them as technologically laggard. We associate them with informality. We associate them with precarity. Now, again, there are important signs that this is changing, and it's changing because of both some if you know the effects of technology. I think the fact of like things like mobile money, the ability of platforms, the ability of apps and AI tools to increase the productivity, everything from street vendors to small entrepreneurs. To sort of self proprietorships in hospitality and food services. So we've seen evidence of how technology is able, new technologies can actually enable productivity growth in these services. But it does also call for a different type of approach of the government. When we think about, I've long been, as you know, proponent of industrial policy, and industrial policy as its name. It's on an industry. So we think about it as sort of manufacturing industry. But I think what we need now increasingly is a kind of an industrial policy for services. And that is a question about governments organizing themselves to provide the kind of public inputs, technology, training, support for entrepreneurship, platforms that essentially provide the vehicles through which the more dynamic of these small firms or micro enterprises can lift their their productivity up, and that sort of is an area for me of active research of trying to figure out what that industrial policy for services might look like.
Yeah, well, that teed up my what my next question was going to be really nicely, because I was going to ask about industrial policy and whether, which I gather from that you feel that it's now a case of taking kind of what we've learned about industrial policy and applying it to services. I think it would be useful to have some more concrete examples of exactly what that looks like, and whether you could expand on what it would look like for industrial policy to target the non-tradable service sector, like you've been describing.
So I think first it's useful to put that discussion in the general context of what kind of industrial policy really works. I think there's a kind of a misleading view of industrial policy based on a kind of a very a partial take of what these Asian countries did, which portrays industrial policy as essentially as a process of top down picking winners, selecting industries, and then using sort of subsidies of various kinds to promote these activities, and then using very hard conditionality based on a kind of a strong state that penalizes or disciplines firms that do not respond appropriately. So that's the kind of a caricature of industrial policy in East Asia. But even in East Asia, I mean, successful industrial policy has taken actually a very different kind of a form than this caricature indicates. And I think that's important because when we take those ideas to services, I think it's we want to carry, the right image of what industrial policy does and how it works. First, it's the industrial policy that's worked is rarely, very top down. It's sort of what the sociologist Peter Evans has called a kind of an embedded kind of process, which is that the agencies, the policymakers that engage in industrial policy, have to be directly engaged with the sectors and the firms that they're dealing with, so that they understand what the problems and the constraints are, rather than sort of keeping them sort of strictly at arm's length and choosing from the top down like central planners. Second, it's really not about picking winners. It's really about experimentation. It's about doing a lot of things and being able to correct your mistakes when they turn out to be. It's really much more about letting the losers go rather than picking the winners. Third, it's really subsidies can play a role, but often as important are the other public inputs that you provide. It could be coordination of different types of services from different types of government ministries. It can be specific types of vocational training. It can be specific provision of technologies. It can be particular types of regulatory assistance or help with particular specific infrastructure or training or business extension or management training. So when you think about, therefore, industrial policy is really much more embedded, it's much more engaged, it's cooperative, it's collaborative, it's experimental, and it entails much more than subsidies. It's sort of much broader set of public inputs that are targeted to the needs of different types of enterprises. Now, what does that mean for services? I think the best way to do this is just to give a couple of examples. One of my favorite examples, for example, is something that was done in the state of Haryana in India, where the state government partners with the local ride-sharing firms, Uber and Ola, to essentially figure out what they need in order to expand their employment of local drivers. So it's a kind of a jobs problem for program for creating more jobs for young drivers in the state. It works for the firms because they want to expand their market and want to expand their reach. It works for the state because they want to provide more jobs for these drivers in the for young people in the state. It's not based on subsidies. There's no hard conditionality. It's collaborative, and it's based on the idea that building trust between the firms, these platforms, and the state, and understanding what their needs and constraints are, so that the firms provide soft commitments to increase the number of work drivers they're going to be employing in return for the state government providing assistance with access to youth who are seeking jobs, easing some of the regulatory restrictions that prevented them from hiring local drivers and giving them commercial licenses, and other types of constraints that these firms were faced, which becomes sort of which the state government learns only after a process of interacting with these firms. Or another example might be, this one actually was not done by a government, by a social enterprise in Colombia, of organizing street vendors in Bogota to essentially give them apps, so a technology that would enable them to coordinate collectively with other street vendors. Their ability to purchase inputs. So the problem that this was, was meant to alleviate was that each one of these street vendors have to spend hours going to a wholesale market early in the morning to pick up their supplies, and it's very costly. And by collectively coordinating the provision of these supplies, that these costs could be reduced, and their ability of these street vendors to access their inputs alleviated. So there are lots of experiments of this kind that are happening, often at the subnational level, because these services are very small. They require sort of addressing the problems of very small scale and local producers. But I think there are a lot of these experiments. Another one that actually is relatively better known is a program in Nigeria, where they created the UWIN program, which was a kind of a competition for entrepreneurship, where the government essentially established kind of a tournament, where sort of young entrepreneurs would present their business plans, and if they made the first cut, then they would get some assistance in terms of some credit, some financial assistance, some business training, some consulting services, and then they would might be able to go on to the next stage and turn these business ideas into real businesses. So the idea is to be able to identify the entrepreneurs of the future. Most of them are going to be doing stuff that's non-tradable services for the local markets. And we know that there is a lot of entrepreneurship possibilities there. How do we provide the kind of complementary services and identify the dynamic microenterprises early on? And these kinds of tournaments are a good way of essentially selecting those. So these are, the types of programs that exist around the world that we need to multiply and we need to build on. But I think the good news is that, this is stuff that already exists. And social enterprises and local governments largely have already been engaged in. But when you talk about sort of the ministries of industry or employment or development, often I think the focus is still on trade, on global value chains, or manufacturing. They're not thinking about industrial policy in those terms.
And you mentioned there about job creation and how that should be a goal for governments and is, I guess, part of the reason why manufacturing is no longer so ideal because it simply doesn't employ as many people as it used to. But I guess manufacturing could still have a number of other benefits for productivity, for learning. There could still be spillovers with the rest of the country, generating foreign exchange. I'd be interested whether you see this as a binary, whether it's kind of now you just don't aim for manufacturing at all, or if you still think it has a role to play in certain sectors and certain countries, even if it's not the shortcut to overall transformation.
Yeah, I think first, I think the jobs perspective is very important. I mean, I've become convinced over the years that really taking a jobs perspective on development is fundamental because ultimately development is really about moving people from less productive jobs to high productivity jobs. That is the essence of development. Now, countries can get rich, in different ways. So, if you're sitting on top of oil fields, you're sitting on top of diamond deposits, you can also get rich off of these natural resources. We know that those kinds of models have a lot of problems, which is lots of inequality, dualistic societies, the cronyism and rent seeking and political and social dysfunction that happens with these sort of enclave economies. In many ways, I fear that a focus on manufacturing is also going to create that kind of an enclave economy. Basically, a lot of what I've said about manufacturing amounts to saying that manufacturing is increasingly becoming like, your oil sector or your diamond or your copper sector, which means that it's tradable, you can get a lot of income. It's capital and skill intensive. It's not going to employ a lot of workers. Now, you can get foreign exchange out of it. You can get a lot of tax revenues out of it. A small number of people will get rich. Does it get you economic development? Not in the classic sense. Manufacturing might have some of the additional benefits you mentioned. I do think that there are spillovers from manufacturing, and I think manufacturing can also be important for, middle-income countries for national security reasons. It could be important for sort of, supply chain resilience kinds of issues. So there are lots of reasons that you may want to focus on manufacturing. I don't want to underestimate the importance of those reasons. But if you're focused on economic development in a sustained way, that's going to sort of lift the majority of the people up from very low productivity jobs, you just have to focus on where those jobs are going to be, which is in these traditionally low productivity services. So, again, it's not that all of a sudden I've started to like services more than I did before. It's just that I see the road, the path having been closed, and therefore we need to do the best that we can of the situation that we find ourselves in. Now, I think, it is the question about choosing. Is it a binary? It's what I'm saying doesn't mean that you should, be anti-manufacturing. If you have, but it does mean that you should be clear about your priorities. That if you're a minister of employment or minister of development or minister of planning, whoever is thinking long term about sort of the growth and development in your economy, it does mean that you should spend a little bit less time, perhaps a lot less time, on the problems of sort of your firms that are either already engaged with global value chains or trying to, and a lot more time on sort of the local firms that might be potentially their suppliers, or the multitudes of hundreds of thousands of tiny micro enterprises and potential entrepreneurs, if not into millions, that are essentially already in your sort of urban areas and trying to sort of which are the backbone of these sort of your middle class services, and that is just going to be critical. So I recently did a kind of a rough a back of the envelope calculation, trying to estimate what the occupation structure of employment in the developing countries would look like in the future. And if we ask the question, what proportion that look at all the developing countries excluding China, so these are all low and middle income countries excluding China, and ask the question, what proportion of the workers in the developing world are either not going to be engaged in international trade in one way or another, either because their jobs cannot be outsourced or they're not working in tradable fields, or they're engaged in occupations that don't require college education? The answer is that three quarters of the workers in the developing countries, roughly, are going to be in occupations that either that neither engage the world economy nor require higher education. So if we don't have an answer to the question, how do we get those workers more productive, we don't have an answer to development.
So we've had lots of questions through, so I'm gonna weave some of those into a question I was going to ask, and then we'll turn to more questions. So keep them coming in, and do vote on the ones, because we probably won't be able to get around to all of them. So I'll be sticking to the ones with the most thumbs up in the Q&A section. I guess, I mean, listening to you talk, it's almost a bit depressing, right? That this shortcut to growth and transformation doesn't seem to be as feasible these days, and the type of approach you're talking about does seem to have a lower ceiling, I guess, in terms of what's possible within a short amount of time. That, I think, raises other issues in terms of being able to sustain that type of growth over a longer period than you would need to sustain the type of East Asian transformation. And I think there's two points there that have been raised in the chat that I'd like to raise. So Kristen Yang has asked about basically the premature deindustrialization being due to automation in manufacturing, and whether with the advances of AI we're seeing, that could potentially hinder the type of service-led approach that you're calling for. And then one of the other big issues or changes in the world is demographic change. And Fiona Stewart has asked how much previous manufacturing-led growth was driven by demographics, and how population peaking might impact the approach you're calling for moving forward. So yeah, two simple questions on AI and demographics, which seem to be two of the most important current changes in the world.
But yeah, I will get to them, but I want to start with the pessimism question, because I think maybe 2 years ago, I was a lot more pessimistic about this, but I just want to, put some of the upsides of what the kind of services led approach to development that I'm talking about. I think the mo probably the most important thing I've learned about services in the last couple of years is that there is evidence that some kind of revolution in productivity in services is taking place in the world. This is most obvious in the advanced countries. So if you look at the United States in the last 2 decades, productivity in services like retail and food services and wholesale has actually increased more rapidly than in manufacturing, sort of reversing a very long-term trend that typically went in the opposite direction. But there is also evidence from the developing countries that services productivity is much higher often than in manufacturing. One recent study I saw the marginal product of labor in services in India is higher than the marginal product of labor in manufacturing. And that's not, again, the IT and the BPO. We're really talking about these local non-tradable consumer services. So and when we think about, sort of that is technology has actually a big, sort of role there that is playing. The kind of advances in technology that we've had, whether it's sort of digital finance, the creation of platforms, the potential sort of market expanding capabilities of the gig economy, and then AI, I think does provide the possibilities of kind of increase in productivity in services, which traditionally have been productively stagnant. Now, let me come more directly to AI. I think AI is different from automation in a very fundamental way, which is that automation was directly labor displacing. When you put a robot in a factory, you're basically removing workers from that factory and letting the robots do the job for of them. Now, AI and other sort of new digital technologies need not be like that. In fact, the most important feature of AI is that it gives the skills and experience of training of much more trained, much more experienced, much more educated professionals, make them available to those that are less so. So in that sense, it's a boon, it's a contribution to the productivity of those that are at the sort of the le least experienced, least skilled part of the of the labor market. And so, we know, for example, that business consulting services can be very effective at increasing the productivity of firms. But it's also they're also very expensive. Now imagine if you had AI systems that were actually locally very well suited to provide consultancy services to micro enterprises, micro entrepreneurs, at low cost. That could potentially be a huge productivity booster for in the informal sectors and for the kinds of services that I'm talking about. So I think, so the potential of AI is part of this revolution in productivity and services that we're seeing around the world. And I think so it needs to be steered. I think we need to ensure that it is being used in that kind of a direction. It's not going to be automatic, which is why I believe that some kind of industrial policy for services is required. But I think it's potentially a very, it's a positive contribution, not a negative one. On demographics, I think the main thing there is that the sort of the demographic story is really twofold. One, of course, there's the youth bulge in Africa, which is sort of this huge growth of the labor force, young labor force in Africa that has to create that have to find jobs. Traditionally, our hope would have been on manufacturing, but I think again, this is realistically our own only path is that we need to make them more productive in what they're doing currently, which is sort of very precarious, kind of low productivity informal work. The other side of the demographic story, of course, is aging, which is creating everywhere, including much more, of course, in the advanced countries, in the middle income countries, kind of demand for care. And that's actually care services is going to be is the largest occupation of the future. And that's really one of the key sectors in these services that we need to figure out how to make jobs in these care sector more productive and better jobs. Again, the use of technology in an appropriate way can be part of it, but we also need to think much more sort of organizational innovations as well, because of obviously a lot of the care in the developing countries is done by unpaid work. It's highly gendered, and I think thinking about that as part of our industrial policy is a critical part of this new approach.
And another question that's come up, which is from Akash Bhatt. So the paper that you've mentioned on services in India, what one finding from that is that a lot of that growth has been very concentrated in large urban centers. Do you feel like that uneven development story is cause for worry, and how do you think about this service-led approach in terms of the implications it might have for inequality?
Yeah, so I think the urban part of the story concerns me less because I think now it's the challenge is really to find productive work for workers who are coming out of agriculture. So agriculture will continue and the rural sector will continue to lose population. I think so. The challenge is to create good productive employment in the urban areas. There is in the Fan et al. Paper a kind of finding that that the implication is that is the richer part of the population benefit more. I'm not 100% convinced of that. I see their argument is that basically, as productivity in these services, consumer services increase, sort of the effective price of these services go down, and the segment in the population that benefits the most are the richest consumers who tend to spend a corresponding larger share of the budget on these services that benefit disproportionately. So there's a kind of an income distribution story there. But I think that story significantly underweights another part of this services-led transformation, that if you are taking a worker who is currently engaged in very precarious, unstable, low productivity, underemployment status in an urban area, you're able to move them to, let's say, in hospitality or in gig work, to something that is more productive, that is more reliable, provides a kind of steady income. I think the gains on the employment side are huge, and those are particularly large for the relatively poorest members of the urban labor force. So I think there's a kind of a compensating effect on the labor side, which that paper, I don't think, because of the structure of its model, is able to track fully. So in fact, I think that this kind of services-based model, especially based on sort of these, middle-class, non-traded, consumer services, has the potential to be much more inclusive, because unlike either resource-based models or export-oriented industrialization models, they're not trickle-down models because those traditional models are just basically creating incomes and employment in the most productive parts of the economy and then waiting for the benefits to trickle down to the rest of the labor force. Whereas a services-based model, in the way that I've described it, which is to actually increase the productivity of workers at the very low end of the productivity spectrum in this precarious service sector jobs, is directly targeting the least productive, the least well-paid, the poorest members of the labor force. So it's a much more inclusive, it's a kind of a bottom-up kind of a development strategy. So I worry less about those unequalizing aspects.
So, getting around to some more questions. So, we've had quite a few people ask about manufacturing and both in terms of the trends we've seen in automation and where that might still leave scope to create jobs in the manufacturing sector. So, Bailey Klinger asked essentially what is behind the increased skill intensity of modern manufacturing. And whether that, given there are still these huge wage differentials between countries, you think there is still a strong incentive to make machines that kind of take advantage of that wage differential. And that links, I guess, to another question. I imagine that one of the kind of subsectors of manufacturing where this applies is something like apparel manufacturing, where as far as I know, there has not been huge automation yet, partly because it doesn't really make financial sense, because labor is still cheaper than designing the types of machines you'd need to do that type of work. So, yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about the trends we've seen in automation and manufacturing, and whether there are these still these pockets where actually you would be able to generate jobs.
I think there is some limited room still for using more labor-intensive techniques or focusing on production segments like garments, where the production techniques tend to be more labor-intensive. But that has been squeezed by, a number of features of what's happened in the world economy recently. So I think the process basically starts with, what we've called skill-biased technological change in American manufacturing after the 1980s. And what that is basically American firms trying to compete with sort of low-cost imports from what was then called newly industrializing countries by essentially through, capital and skill upgrading, since because they couldn't compete on the basis of low labor costs, they invested heavily in much more skill and capital-intensive technologies to be able to compete. Now, that didn't hugely succeed, but what it did was change the frontier, the technological frontier in manufacturing, in a direction that was much more skill and capital intensive. Now, what that means for an Ethiopia or a Bangladesh or a Vietnam that's trying to compete now in those segments is that in order to be able to join the global value chains in those segments, they essentially have to satisfy the same quality standards, the same kind of requirements, the same technological certifications that you need to be part of that global value chain. And that puts very specific requirements. It may not be necessarily, just more years of education. It may not be automation and robots. But it does provide, sort of it does make claims on your basic technological and infrastructural and governance capabilities that traditionally manufacturing did not do so. This is why even in Bangladesh and Vietnam, if you ask any firm or you look at all the international reports and say, what is the constraint that these firms are facing? It's skill upgrading. It's about technological upgrading. These were not the issues that people talked about in South about South Korea and Taiwan back in the 1970s, when those countries were at the stage of industrialization that countries like Vietnam are today. So the nature of the challenge has really, or just to give a more sort of a very an example for import substitution. Now, I grew up in a country in Turkey where a lot of the manufacturing industrialization was based actually on import substitution, like in Brazil or in Mexico until the 1980s. That was a lot of industrialization that took place, but it was because there was kind of a protected home market. You could have firms that were producing relatively shoddy, low quality, toys and garments and bicycles that were building look capabilities over time that was working in terms of growth because you were still getting, workers out from the countryside into more productive firm jobs in the urban areas. But you had segmented markets and you were able to provide a lot of jobs in segments of manufacturing that were relatively, were able to do to produce. Now, if you're, Ethiopia today, even with your tariff barriers against China, there's no way you can actually sort of maintain industries that can compete against China, given, sort of the kind of investment China has made in their industries. And so it's a much more different world in terms of, what kind of segments and what kinds of manufacturing activities you're able to sustain, both because of much lower levels of protection, much more integrated world markets, the presence of China, the demanding requirements of global value chains. So I think this is it's not just automation. And it is a kind of a broader range of organizational and competitive changes in the global market that is essentially is they're all together making it harder for countries to industrialize in the traditional way.
Thank you so much, Danny, for all of your answers today and your wide-ranging thoughts on all the different varied topics and examples and countries that we've discussed. This has been an episode of Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure that you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also have a Substack where I'll be uploading some show notes that contain some of the specific sources that Danny has been referencing today. There was a couple of questions about that in the chat. I've also put in the chat a link to our Vox Dev Lit on industrial development, which I think is a nice wide-ranging piece that covers a lot of the topics that Danny has discussed today with a whole chapter on service-led growth. And I think there's a lot of sources in there as well if you're interested in reading further about this topic and these big questions on growth. So Danny, thanks again.
Thank you, Oliver, and thanks for everybody else who joined.